Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. For the next 60 minutes, we review some of the top stories from our VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Today, you'll hear that any deal the U.S. president might make with the North Korean leader will still face scrutiny in the U.S. Congress.
You have to bring it to Congress, and Congress has a period of time under which to review it and disapprove of it.
And we talked to a college professor not so fond of the way the U.S. and China are handling trade disputes.
You are in a trade war. The big issue is, how bad will it be?
Those stories and much more on today's edition of VOA Asia Weekend. As U.S. President Donald Trump prepares for next week's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, the U.S. Congress is asserting its right to review and potentially reject any nuclear deal that emerges from the historic encounter. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman has this report.
The much-anticipated Trump-Kim summit is prompting expressions of hope on Capitol Hill from senators like Democrat Ben Cardin.
I'm very pleased to see that we're moving forward with diplomacy.
And Republican James Risch.
This thing can be solved. It really can be.
But any accord hammered out at the Singapore summit will have to satisfy lawmakers, including Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
You have to bring it to Congress, and Congress has a period of time under which to review it and disapprove of it.
Specifically, lawmakers say Congress would have to agree to the sanctions relief Pyongyang desires and will not do so absent strict conditions. Republican Senator Cory Gardner spelled them out.
There can be no sanctions relief for North Korea unless the regime makes significant progress toward completely, verifiably, and irreversibly dismantling all of its nuclear, chemical, biological, and radiological weapons.
Risch says North Korea has repeatedly negotiated in bad faith and cheated on past accords.
The history's been just awful. We've been taken to the cleaners, not just once on this, where we started giving stuff, and then at the end of the day, they pulled the carpet out from under us. That is not going to happen again.
Trump has repeatedly stressed the summit may or may not produce an accord. Either way, the eyes of the world will be on Singapore next week, including those of skeptical U.S. lawmakers. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
China was warning the United States last Sunday that any trade and business agreements between the two countries would be void if President Donald Trump carried out his threats to impose tariff hikes and other trade measures. The warning came after U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and the Chinese Deputy Prime Minister Liu He ended a new round of talks Sunday in Beijing aimed at settling a simmering trade dispute in which Beijing pledged to buy more American products to narrow its trade surplus with the United States. The Chinese trade surplus reached $375 billion last year. No joint statement was issued, and neither side released any details. Trump is threatening to hike duties on up to $150 billion of Chinese imports, with Beijing vowing to retaliate in kind. The White House renewed a threat last week to hike duties on $50 billion of Chinese technology-related goods in that dispute. I spoke with Jeffrey Bergstrand, professor of finance at Notre Dame University.
Well, first of all, the Trump administration was the start of all this in terms of raising tariffs, especially on manufactured goods, steel in particular, also aluminum, but it's done it on countries around the world. So the response by China in terms of, say, voiding any trade and business agreements as a retaliatory measure is feasible. How much impact that will have is pretty limited. Basically, it's a retaliatory measure. But the notion that they are going to curtail trade and business agreements doesn't have much impact, because those could be small agreements, those could be partnership agreements, but they're not under the rules of an economic integration agreement.
How much different is the Trump policy and style in negotiating and talking with China as his predecessors?
Completely different. The U.S. president, the current U.S. president, Trump administration is starting a trade war. Historically, this is unprecedented since the 1930s, where the most similar situation would have been the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which were brought in under Hoover, and that exacerbated the Great Recession of the early 1930s into the Great Depression with the collapse of world trade, which collapsed by about two-thirds.
Do you think this is a war of simply threats, or do you expect a trade war, a real trade war, to break out? And if so, what kind of effect is that going to have on the American and Chinese consumer?
Well, the way I see it is that a trade war exists once at least one party starts creating barriers to trade, which these tariffs on steel and aluminum will do. And then we know it's a war because the other side responds. China responds by raising tariffs proportionally to do as much damage as was done to them. Same thing for the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. So once you have one party starts creating protectionism, which is what the Trump administration is doing, and other parties partake in terms of a tit-for-tat kind of situation, you are in a trade war. The big issue is, how bad will it be?
And what would be the effect on the consumers, be they in China, be they in the United States, or even worldwide?
What happens is this is going to lower the overall volume of trade. And so in the end, employment will go down in these industries. You know, in the short run, it's going to boost employment. But, you know, within a couple of years, the collapse of the world economy will eventually hurt employment and create very high unemployment in the country and depressing economic conditions.
You're calling for the collapse of the world economy?
It depends on the degree to which this escalates. Given what they've done so far, it's damaging the U.S. economy and damaging the Chinese economy and the other economies where these are going into play. If it escalates to a much higher degree, then it could collapse the world economy. It's not at that level yet. It's just the first round. So it's a beginning, but it could stop. It could stop here. Or it could escalate. Very hard to see at this point.
Jeffrey Bergstrand, professor of finance at Notre Dame University. While the U.S.-China trade and tariff disputes remain unresolved, Trump last week imposed new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from the European Union, Canada, and Mexico, angering three key U.S. allies who vowed to retaliate by imposing new duties on American goods. The U.S.-based Ocean Infinity says its search for the wreckage of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, missing for 4 years now, would come to an end following a much larger and expensive international effort to solve one of modern aviation's great mysteries. The Boeing 777 disappeared soon after takeoff from Kuala Lumpur, March 8, 2014, on a flight to Beijing with 239 people, most of them Chinese, aboard. Fragments believed to have been part of the aircraft washed ashore on western Indian Ocean coastlines. Families of the victims have demanded the search go on. Clive Kessler is a longtime Malaysia expert and professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales. He told VOA's Victor Beatty there would be two compelling reasons to restart the search.
On the specific grounds that there are the families of those 239 people who were on the aeroplane who died, who disappeared, and who need to know what happened. And the general case is, look, here, this is a matter of confidence in world aviation itself, and they can't just let a plane disappear and say, oh, look, terribly sorry about that, it went astray, nothing more to be said.
Now, Malaysian government is due out with a report on the search and the disappearance of the aircraft, and there's some concern that it will be fully transparent. Do you think it will be?
I can't be sure about that. What they have agreed to do is to release the report that was prepared by the previous government. And they have said that they are quite happy to open it up, as they are with a number of things that the previous government did, in order to let people see what went on and to confirm the doubts in many ways that people had about the previous government. I have doubts that the report produced by the previous government, even if it's transparently revealed, will tell very much, because there was an enormous amount of face and hypothesis saving went on after the series of misjudgments that went into the initial crisis management and initiation of the search. My suspicion is that the report that was prepared, and which will now be revealed, will be part of, if not a cover-up, part of the same fudging and blurring of the issues that the Malaysian government, the previous Malaysian government, was into from really the word go in many ways.
Is there anything beyond just pure theory and speculation as to what happened to this aircraft?
Look, there's not much that's washed up. There are some people said a lot of stuff washed up on Mozambique that may or may not have been, but the fact that nothing washed up is compatible with two totally contradictory scenarios. One is that the plane crashed as it did. There was high impact, and it was a time when a cyclone went through, and the bottom of the Indian Ocean is a great churn like a huge washing machine, and everything just got crunched up and pulverized into tiny fragments. The other view, and this is the view of these four experienced pilots, is that if it was a controlled landing, then most of the aircraft, with the exception of that part wing, the flapperon or something that came off at impact, would have remained intact together and gone down in one or two or three large pieces in close proximity to the bottom of the ocean.
Well, regardless of which scenario may or may not be true, the fact is this aircraft was off course. It was on a flight in March 2014 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, had no business being over the Indian Ocean.
Absolutely not. It's quite clear now that the pilot or somebody in the plane who they have hijacked, it was probably the pilot, diverted the aeroplane, turned it round across the Gulf of Siam, back across the Malay Peninsula, into the Andaman Sea, did a very complicated navigational route across the fuzzy zones that between Malaysian and Thai airspace and Malaysian and Indonesian airspace, and evaded the main way stations in order to get through and get out into the southern Indian Ocean.
Clive Kessler said that is in line with one of the few clues about the fate of Flight 370, Inmarsat satellite communications data that indicated the plane crashed in the southern Indian Ocean. 29 years ago, a violent suppression of peaceful demonstrations in and around Tiananmen Square resulted in the countless loss of innocent lives. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo released a statement calling on the Chinese government to make a full public accounting of those killed, detained, or missing, to release those who have been jailed for striving to keep the memory of Tiananmen Square alive, and to end the continued harassment of demonstration participants and their families. Meanwhile, a Chinese artist in Australia called for people around the world to pose as the iconic Tank Man on that day to commemorate the 29th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. Tank Man was an unidentified man who stood in front of a line of moving tanks the next day on June 5, 1989. The identity of the man and his eventual fate remain unknown. We do know who took the photograph. American Jeff Widener, who was working for the Associated Press. He shared his story of taking the photo with my colleague Jim Stevenson and told about some of the many obstacles that could have prevented the world from ever seeing it.
Well, I was a Southeast Asia picture editor for Associated Press. My job was basically to cover the southern region. However, this story was building into something really big, so they wanted me to come up there and help out on the story. The problem was that the Beijing government didn't want to give me a journalist visa, and they denied it. So I had to figure out another way to get into China. I booked a tourist coming as a tourist. And when I got in there to the airport, I had to figure out a way to smuggle all my camera gear in. And this is a big concern. I thought I might get arrested. Fortunately, something was going on with an old lady and a live chicken in the corner of the terminal, and all the customs guys ran off to the side and left me alone, and I just pushed the cart through to the waiting taxis and got to the AP office. From that point on, my job was to go to Tiananmen Square every morning and photograph the activities. And it was, a very jovial experience, almost like a carnival atmosphere. Everybody was celebrating this new freedom that they had. Eventually, I was given the order to do the first night shift. On the night of June 4th, I went out, and things started really getting pretty heavy. There was a burning armored car, and I lifted the camera to my eye. At the second, a large brick hit me in the face. The camera absorbed the blow. Fortunately, it saved my life. And then I had to get back to the AP office and file. I didn't go back out. I was just too scared. I was sick. I had a massive concussion. And the following day, I got a message again from AP. We don't want anyone to take any unnecessary risk, but if somebody could please photograph the Occupy Tiananmen Square, we'd appreciate it. So I drew the small straw again, and it was my job to go to the Beijing Hotel, which had the closest vantage point. And I got there, and I had to get past secret police who were using electric cattle prods on the journalist. Fortunately, one young college kid from America named Kirk Martson, he managed to smuggle me up into his room, and that's where I made the Tank Man photograph.
This must have been an absolutely astounding scene that was playing out before your eyes as you're watching this lone gentleman walk out into the street in front of a line of tanks.
It was and it wasn't, because you have to remember I had a massive concussion. I was really spaced out, and nothing was really making a lot of sense to me. So seeing a guy walking out in the middle of a boulevard with shopping bags and confronting tanks just seemed par for the course. And actually, when I saw the tanks coming down the street, I lined up my 400-millimeter lens, and I thought, well, you know, it's a nice shot. And the guy walks out, and the first thing I said, well, this guy's going to screw up my composition. And then Kirk's screaming, they're going to kill him, they're going to kill him. And so, you know, I looked at this guy just waiting for the instant he was going to be, you know, shot. But nothing happened, you know, and he's just still there standing there. And so I realized the picture was too far away, and I looked back at the bed where I had a lens doubler. This would increase my focal length to 800 millimeter. So the situation was, do I gamble and maybe miss the shot completely, or do I go and try to increase the magnification to get a better picture? Well, I did that, and I took three frames, and I realized something was wrong with my camera setting. The shutter speed was too slow. And by that time, Tank Man was taken away. It was an error I made on the sensitivity of the film. But fortunately, one picture came out.
How were you able to get your film out of there with so much security in the hotel?
Well, thank God for Kirk Martson, because he was instrumental in not only getting me to the roof to photograph the occupied Tiananmen Square, which is my main goal, but he also helped me with getting the film past the secret police. You know, he just looked like a, you know, sort of a college student. He had short pants on, sandals, a dirty Rambo T-shirt. You know, he just looked like, you know, a young kid. And so he smuggled all my film into his shorts, and I remember standing on the balcony looking straight below me, and you could see the security guys. They're all sitting there having a smoke break, and so Kirk just strolls right by them, you know, one of the most iconic images and most embarrassing images for China, and he just walks by these guys with their cigarettes, gets on a bicycle, slowly unchains it, and I'm just looking down saying, go, 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 go. And then he gets on the bike and starts pedaling away, although a little bit awkwardly, because all his film's in his, you know, shorts, and it's a painful experience, I guess, riding with that much film in your shorts. But he goes all the way down to the looking for the AP office, can't find it, is smart enough to think about going to the American Embassy, tells him it's very important film and it needs to go to AP. Fortunately, the American Embassy did that. They transferred the film over to the office, and it was transmitted to the rest of the world, and that's how it was done. Mm. And he really risked his life doing that.
You were dealing with film in that era. I mean, it wasn't like a digital camera of today, and this had to be developed and then transmitted.
Well, you're right about that. And, in fact, that impact from the rock that hit me, it hit the camera when it was to my face. It ripped the entire top of the camera off, the flash, the lens, shattered the mirror, and bent the titanium shutter curtain. That's how strong the impact was. And when we got the film back to the office, Mark Avery, who was the photo editor then for AP, he had to go in the dark room and literally take pliers to pry the film out to develop it. And so the other thing that's interesting about that is that because we were so busy, the chemicals were not refreshed properly. So the Tank Man negative actually started disintegrating almost immediately. And fortunately, AP managed to preserve it long enough digitally before it completely disintegrated. And right now, it basically, the negative is just gone completely.
One other interesting caveat to the story, Jeff Widener had run out of film and was fortunate enough to secure a role from a tourist. That was the film used for the Tank Man photo. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs, such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
In an attempt to bridge the gap of understanding between different Indian communities, a house in the Indian capital of New Delhi is trying to foster the message of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in a unique manner. The house gives people from different religions and communities the chance to live together as a family for up to 6 months as a way to promote understanding. VOA's Ritul Joshi reports from New Delhi.
In the Jamianagar neighborhood of Delhi, this nondescript narrow lane leads to a very special house. Sabka Ghar, or House for All, is an initiative to help people of different faiths understand each other.
The way we imagine India, a place where Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs and Christians live together and understand each other, Sabka Ghar is just that, a mini India.
Sabka Ghar is a place to get some relief. Here we talk of things which bring people together.
The idea for the house comes from an organization which is trying to revive the Khudai Khidmatgar movement in India. Khudai Khidmatgar, or Servants of God, was originally a social reform movement started by Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan in India before its independence from Britain in 1947. Set up in 2017, this house allows people from different religions to stay under one roof as a family. 5 to 6 people can live here at a time for a minimum of 2 days to a maximum of 6 months.
We don't hold any workshops on peace and conflict here, nor do we give them lengthy notes. We just ask them simple questions like, were the Hindus created by China or America? They say no, by Allah. Then why should there be any conflict, we say.
Our understanding of social coexistence widens, and slowly we see an improvement in ourselves too.
I get a chance to learn about other religions. With such understanding, I develop respect for other communities and religions.
So far, 1,600 people from across India have spent time in this house. Another Sabka Ghar house has opened its doors in the southern Indian state of Kerala to spread the message of tolerance and harmony. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, New Delhi.
A pill could soon radio signals from inside your gut to help doctors diagnose diseases from ulcers to cancer to inflammation. That according to a new study. Scientists have developed a small, ingestible capsule that mixes biology and electronics to detect bleeding in the digestive tract. VOA's Steve Barragona shared details.
The biological part of the pill uses bacteria engineered to glow when exposed to heme, the iron-containing molecule in blood. The electronic side includes a tiny light detector, computer chip, battery, and a transmitter that sends data to a cell phone or computer. It all fits in a capsule 3 centimeters long by 1 centimeter wide, says Massachusetts Institute of Technology electrical engineer Philip Nadeau.
You know, a major challenge for sensing in the GI tract is just the space available for a device is very limited.
Nadeau says with more engineering work, they can probably shrink the pill to a third of its current size. In laboratory tests, it successfully distinguished pigs fed small amounts of blood from those not given blood. It has not been tested on humans yet, but the team aims to do so in the next year or two. It's a good first step, but it may not be sensitive enough to detect disease in a real patient, says Rice University bioengineer Jeff Tabor, who was not part of the research team.
For many actual diseases, you might have far less of the molecule that you need to sense available to you in the body.
But Tabor says he's excited about the work, and it's a big advance. The research is published in the journal Science. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Pablo Picasso's painting of Golden Muse, Marie Therese Walter, estimated to be worth up to $45 million, is on display in Hong Kong. The highly celebrated painting of his secret mistress of many years is the highlight of a collection of treasured works of art by old master painters that will be up for sale in London. VOA's Julie Tambo told us more.
A portrait of Pablo Picasso's Golden Muse, Marie Therese, debuted in Hong Kong on Friday, May 25th, ahead of Sotheby's summer season in London. The painting, unveiled in public for the first time in 20 years, is estimated to be worth as much as $45 million. It was painted in 1932, during Picasso's so-called Year of Wonders, when he is said to have been inspired by women, including Marie Therese and others, according to Sotheby's Augusto Uribe.
1932 is the golden year in which he really has a profoundly intimate relationship with Marie Therese. So paintings from that era, from that year in particular, are much more calm, tender, sweet. And as his relationship with her became a little more staid and slightly more antagonistic, then his depictions of her were a bit more, let's say, aggressive.
The painting is on display alongside a selection of Dutch and Flemish masterpieces before heading to London for a sale on June 19th. Classic masterpiece paintings are popular in the Asian market, says Andrew Fletcher, who heads Sotheby's Old Masters auction sales.
Collectors in Asia for Old Masters have tended in the past to come from Hong Kong. More and more, we see them coming from mainland China, from Taiwan. And we've also got more and more collectors coming from Japan as well.
Picasso, who died at the age of 91, was one of the most prolific artists of the 20th century, creating more than 13,000 paintings, along with countless prints and illustrations, in a career that spanned 78 years. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
After 2 days of trade talks in Beijing, China Monday said it had made positive and concrete progress with the United States, adding there was good communication in agricultural and energy sectors following the consensus reached 2 weeks ago in Washington. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross described the talks Saturday and Sunday as friendly and frank. While China has offered to buy more from other nations, including the United States, by increasing imports, the Trump administration has demanded China also implement structural changes dealing with joint venture requirements and intellectual property theft. Last week, the U.S. threatened 25% tariffs on $50 billion of Chinese exports with Beijing, vowing retaliation. University of Maryland economics professor Peter Morisi told VOA's Victor Beatty that China is stonewalling the U.S. and undermining the disciplines of the World Trade Organization.
We're not alone in being concerned about China. The European Union has filed a WTO case. Unfortunately, the WTO doesn't work very well for the kind of stuff that China does, and we're trying to negotiate with them directly. Frankly, they're not taking us very seriously, and so I wouldn't be surprised if they get slapped with some punitive tariffs.
China indicates that it's going to buy more from other countries, including the U.S., but the U.S. says they also want structural changes.
Absolutely. Buying more sorghum doesn't do us a whole lot of good. I mean, it makes the farmers feel better for a little while, but China's targeting artificial intelligence, the microprocessors that go into robotics and so forth. They're targeting one major industry after another with massive government subsidies. They're denying us market access for our truly competitive manufacturing products. China's just not playing fair. And frankly, I think that so far, Donald Trump has gone easy with China. If I were president of the United States, President Xi wouldn't want to get out of bed in the morning.
So are we headed for a trade war?
We're in a trade war. China's been conducting one for years. They've been targeting American industries, closing their markets, taking advantage of WTO rules that were put there for poorer nations. China is not a poor nation. China is a trade abuser. China is a trade criminal. And China's got to clean up its act. The real question is whether Donald Trump's going to put his big boy pants on and really do business with China the way it needs to be done, or he's going to settle for a deal on soybeans, sorghums, and SUVs.
Well, the latest round of trade talks, at least Mr. Ross's part in it in Beijing, is over. What happens next?
Well, we have to see what he brought back, and we'll know more about that this week. But if it's just some offers on some agricultural products and cars, well, it's nice to sell more of that stuff. We've been asking for major changes, and if we don't get them, Donald Trump has to decide whether he's going to back down or he's going to really challenge China. I can't answer the question as to what's going to happen next.
Mr. Trump's comments about ZTE Corporation, the Chinese telecom giant, is he backing off or is he still threatening basically to halt operations?
Well, right now operations are halted. They cannot buy American parts, and we'll see how that works out. But that's just a little piece of the problem. That's a cell phone maker. We have much bigger problems with China, and China doesn't want to play by the rules of civilized nations. You know, one of the things I know when I make a deal with the Chinese, either they're not telling the truth or they're going to break their word.
In an editorial, the state-run Global Times said Washington's on, then off, then on tariff threat likely means a protracted trade dispute. It called on the U.S. to choose what it really wants, more tariffs or more exports. North Korea's three top military leaders were replaced this past week. Quoting an unidentified source inside South Korea's intelligence agency, South Korean news agency Yonhap said the new leaders are No Kwang-chol, who is replacing Park Young-sik as defense chief, Ri Yang-gil, who becomes chief of the general staff of the Korean People's Army, replacing Ri Myung-soo, and Army General Kim Soo-gil as the new leader of General Political Bureau of the Korean People's Army, replacing Kim Jong-guk. The intelligence agency source told Yonhap the changes were made due to the new push toward détente with South Korea and the United States, noting that the three previous leaders lack flexibility in thinking. The changes could be aimed at bringing the military in line ahead of a potential denuclearization deal between leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump at their planned June 12 summit in Singapore. But another intelligence source says the replacements could also represent a generational change. Scott Snyder, senior fellow for Korean studies at the Washington-based Council for Foreign Relations, told me the timing of the changes made in Pyongyang are quite telling.
Time is really the critical question because we see that there are other domestic policies in North Korea that are being adjusted or revamped, most notably the commitment by the party to move forward with an economic reform agenda that appears to downplay or remove the focus on nuclear development. And of course, this is against the backdrop of Kim Jong-un's meeting with Moon Jae-in and a prospective meeting with Donald Trump in Singapore next week.
Is this unprecedented, or have similar changes been made before other meetings, important meetings?
I think that we've seen a lot of flux in terms of the positions within the military over the course of the time that Kim Jong-un has been in power. But this comes against the backdrop of Kim Jong-un establishing international relations with top leaders that really didn't exist prior to the end of this year.
Is this a win for Donald Trump and the United States?
No, it's too early to be able to say. What we do need to see alongside a commitment to denuclearization is evidence of sincerity through internal domestic political changes that this is actually meaningful. So I do think that it is important that there is evidence of internal change inside North Korea. And of course, we just had Kim Jong-chol in the White House, and he is known as a hardliner, and yet he was delivering a letter from Kim Jong-un. So, you know, there are reasons to anticipate potentially some further changes by Kim Jong-un, but I really think we have to wait and see.
Do you think that Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans are expecting some kind of reciprocal actions before the summit between Trump and Kim take place? Not necessarily nuclear, but anything.
I think actually the meeting at the White House may have been the signal to Kim Jong-un that the U.S. is prepared to move forward on some of the issues that he is most concerned about, including an adjustment to what North Korea perceives as the hostile policy of the United States. And there's no bigger signal that the U.S. may be prepared to change that policy than a meeting with the U.S. president. And then also there is the possibility that we would see, you know, something along the lines of tension reduction, security guarantees, or even a declaration that presages an end to a formal end to the Korean War.
In your view, what has been the role of South Korea in this entire scenario?
Well, President Moon in South Korea has been the biggest risk taker, but also has played a very important, really a critical facilitating role in bringing the U.S. And North Korea together. And here I think the important aspect of the way that South Korea has done this under Moon Jae-in is that he has tried to open the way, but he's definitely trying to do it together with the United States. And that's important because past efforts to reach out to North Korea by South Korea have ended up foundering as a result of a lack of support from the United States for such efforts.
Do you think that initial reports are true that say that Donald Trump wanted to go in and just have a one-day meeting, originally anyway, have a one-day meeting and then everything would be fine? Now he's talking more about taking a longer time. How do you think about this whole thing?
I think it's an important development that President Trump is talking now about a process possibly involving a series of meetings. I think that is a more realistic approach, but at the same time, it does raise the question of whether or not in the initial stages we're going to see the kind of strategic commitment on the part of North Korea to denuclearization that would truly convince the outside world that Kim Jong-un is really committed to full, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization.
Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korean Studies at the Washington-based Council for Foreign Relations. We are very happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Australia's intelligence laws are to be reviewed in the most comprehensive overhaul of national security legislation in decades. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the story.
The review will take 18 months and will be led by a former spy chief. It will be the most comprehensive review of Australia's intelligence laws since the 1970s. Much of its terms of reference are being kept secret, but officials say the shake-up will look at how information is shared among the nation's six security and intelligence agencies, as well as with other law enforcement bodies. Analysts say the review is long overdue, with existing laws designed for a previous era. They say the review would likely address the main threats facing Australia: terrorism, cyber warfare, and influence by foreign powers. Australia's Federal Attorney General Christian Porter says the overhaul will help to integrate the various agencies that keep the nation safe.
The control, direction and coordination of all of these agencies and the way they interact with non-intelligence agencies and state-based agencies such as state police forces. It's looking at how we share information and whether or not that can be improved on. It's looking at the overall staffing and resources, so it has a very holistic approach. And the other thing it'll look at is accountability and oversight.
The review comes amid rising fears in Australia over the influence of China in its domestic affairs. Earlier this week, media reports detailed allegations apparently contained in a top-secret report that China has attempted to influence Australia's political parties for the past decade, as well as every level of government. Beijing has previously accused Australia of being anti-China. Last year, the Australian government introduced new foreign interference laws into federal parliament, which, if passed, would put a ban on all overseas political donations. In January, Australian opposition Senator Sam Dastyari was forced to resign over alleged links to Chinese authorities. Australia's national terrorism threat level remains set at probable, which means security agencies believe that individuals or groups have the intent and capability to carry out a terrorist attack in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Environmentalists and volunteers in the Philippines pedaled bikes last Sunday to call attention to the impact of plastic bottles on the environment. The bike ride came after green activists collected trash Saturday along the coast at a nearby bird sanctuary. Arash Arabasadi reported the cleanup and bike ride came ahead of World Environmental Day on June 5th.
More than 200 cyclists took to the streets of Manila, advocating for a plastic-free Philippines. Bikers say they are riding to raise awareness of plastic's impact on the environment by bringing fellow cyclists closer to nature.
And we believe that as long as at least one person that gets involved in biking, he will understand the importance of the environment and clean air, water, land, and oceans, because he is closer to nature, closer to it every day.
Organizers set up water stations along the nearly 13-kilometer ride to encourage cyclists to fill reusable containers with water rather than buy or receive disposable plastic bottles.
The problem with plastic usage in the Philippines, everybody considers it to be single use. They throw it away. No, they don't give it back to recycling areas. You should be able to recycle plastic. You should bring them, dispose of them properly.
The event's hashtag, Break Free from Plastic, is a call to action in rethinking how people use and dispose of plastics. Saturday, ahead of the bike ride, 24 volunteers picked up trash that washed ashore outside a bird sanctuary on the edge of the capital. Freedom Island is less than a kilometer from Manila, and it hosts 41 species of migratory birds from August to April.
And through little ways like cleanup drives, environmental talks, you know, celebrations of days like World Environment Day, we are bringing information to the people so that they can be made aware that they're not just here to exist, but to preserve what they have now and even make it better for the generations to come.
According to the U.S.-based group Ocean Conservancy, the Philippines produces more than 2.5 million metric tons of plastic waste every year. The cleanup and cycling efforts come in advance of World Environment Day, which is on Tuesday, June 5th. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
China has blasted the United States for flying a pair of B-52 bombers near disputed islands in the South China Sea, further fueling tensions between the two countries. The Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, Hua Chunying, accusing the U.S. of stirring up trouble and warning China will not be threatened by any military warships. Hua said China would do whatever is necessary to protect its sovereignty. The bombers flew near Scarborough Shoal, which China seized from the Philippines 6 years ago. The flyby occurred after U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis accused China of intimidation and coercion in the South China Sea. We welcome to VOA Asia Bonnie Glaser. Bonnie is a senior advisor for Asia and the director of the China Power Project at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Bonnie, thanks for being with us. We know that China is claiming the entire South China Sea, plus more than that. What does the U.S. want them to do? Has the United States expressed anything definitive?
Well, over the years, not only in the Trump administration, but also in the Obama administration, the United States has called for China to not increase tensions, to exercise self-restraint, to negotiate a code of conduct with the other claimants and frankly, all of Southeast Asia, that are these 10 countries that are members of ASEAN, so that they can peacefully manage their disputes. And the United States has essentially asked China, as it has asked all countries, to abide by international law. And there was an arbitral tribunal finding in July of 2016 that the nine-dash line does not have any legal standing. Therefore, claims that any country makes to any land features in the South China Sea and water has to be in accordance with the Convention on the Law of the Sea. So if you claim water, it has to extend from land. China continues to say that it has some ill-defined claim of historic rights and jurisdiction over a large swath of the waters in the South China Sea. And so I do think that the United States has been clear about what all countries should do, and it is not singling out China. There should be no militarization, no construction of fake islands, and everybody should abide by law and look for peaceful ways to manage disputes.
But China is paying no attention to those pleas.
Well, that's pretty much correct. China has, I think, a blueprint for what it wants to do in the South China Sea. It continues to militarize its islands. It continues to intimidate and bully its neighbors. It has recently threatened both the Philippines and Vietnam with military force if they go ahead and exploit energy reserves, energy deposits that are inside their legal maritime boundaries, what's known as the 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. That's very much illegal. So when the U.S. says the rights of small countries and large countries alike should be respected, it has those kinds of actions in mind. So the Chinese indeed are really not exercising self-restraint at all. They are acting in accordance with their own interests, and they are damaging the interests of other countries.
How big of a flashpoint is this?
Well, I really don't think that the U.S. and China are going to have a military conflict in the South China Sea, even if there were an accident, say, between two ships or two aircraft. And some of your listeners may remember that in 2001, there actually was a collision between a U.S. surveillance aircraft and a Chinese jet. The Chinese pilot died. The Americans that were on board the surveillance aircraft did land in an emergency landing in Hainan Island, and they all survived. But that could happen again. So, yes, there's a risk of accident. There certainly is a high risk of growing tensions. But I don't think that there is a very great likelihood that we're going to see a war that is triggered in the South China Sea.
You see a way out of this?
I think that there will be competition that will go on for some time. I don't think that China is going to make concessions. And I think that the United States will continue to exercise freedom of navigation. But the United States can't roll back what China has achieved. It's turning of these islands into military outposts. So I think in peacetime, China will continue to use these outposts to coerce their neighbors. I think the U.S. doesn't have a good toolbox to prevent that. And as long as we don't go to war, then there will never be any real use of the military capabilities to fight each other. I don't see any near-term solution unless China decides that its relations with the rest of the region are more important than what it's trying to do in the South China Sea. Right now, China thinks it can have its cake and eat it, too. It can have both the good relations with the region, and it can build up these military outposts. And as long as it sees it can do both, it will do both. So the real question is how to shape a strategy that forces China to choose. And that can only be done if the claimants and the other members in ASEAN will stand up against China, push back and say, our interests matter too. But for obvious reasons, they're all afraid to do so. And they don't think that the United States has their back, and they're probably right.
Bonnie Glaser is a senior advisor for Asia and the director of the China Power Project at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Thanks so much, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Gene therapy could potentially allow doctors to cure some of the deadliest types of cancer and rare hereditary diseases with just one injection. The FDA recently approved the use of three anti-cancer drugs, all based on genetically modified human cells. Scientists say up to 80% of all types of cancer will respond to gene therapy treatments in the future. And as VOA's Daria Dygatz reported, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Brother. 17-year-old Christian Gordino is a talented singer from New York who advanced to the semifinals of NBC's America's Got Talent last year. But the competitive spotlight has not been easy. Christian was born with a rare hereditary eye disease that gradually causes blindness. By the age of 12, he was able to see only bright light. When he was 13, Gordino was accepted into a clinical trial for a new gene therapy treatment using a drug called Luxturna. It was designed to help those who suffer from mutations of a gene called RPE65, which produces a protein vital for normal vision.
So basically, Dr. Bennett and the team were able to clone the gene, the RPE65 gene that Christian was missing. And then once it attaches, the RPE65 gene starts to produce the proteins that he was missing all those years.
After the gene therapy, I've been able to see so many incredible things like the moon, the stars, sunset, snow falling. These things I would have never been able to see perform my gene therapy.
In the late 1980s, scientists discovered that the body's own lymphocytes were capable of killing melanoma. But it took another two decades before they managed to genetically modify cells against other types of cancer and transplant them into a patient's body.
We put the gene that encodes that ability to recognize the cancer into the lymphocyte, and we use viruses to do that, a special kind of virus that can insert the gene into these lymphocytes. We then grow them to large numbers. What that now gives us is a large vat of cells that can recognize the cancer, and we infuse it intravenously into the patient.
That means one injection can potentially kill cancer cells.
These molecules that we're targeting are not in any normal cells. And so we don't see any normal cell destruction the way you might see with chemotherapy or radiation therapy. So those complications don't exist. But sometimes when the immune system really gets roiled up, it can start secreting molecules that can cause a low blood pressure and other kinds of symptoms.
That's why more research is still needed to look at the safety and effectiveness of the new therapy.
We want to make sure that over the course of time, people are safe with these because they're gene therapies, they can affect one's genes. And so we ask for long-term follow-up.
These new therapies are very expensive. The drug that Christian received costs $500,000 per eye. But for patients who do not respond to traditional treatments, they may offer the only hope for a cure. Daria Digus for VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for being with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. The 2012 rape of a 23-year-old physiotherapy student on a New Delhi bus put the spotlight on brutal violence against women in the Indian capital. But there has been lesser attention on sexual harassment, such as lewd comments or groping that girls and women routinely face in public places, locally known as eve teasing. To equip them to counter sexual assault in a city known as one of India's most unsafe for women, police have been teaching self-defense techniques to tens of thousands. Anjana Prasricha visited one such summer training camp in the Indian capital.
One of the tactics that police women are teaching in a park in New Delhi is how to tackle men who fall on girls deliberately during crowded bus journeys or touch them improperly. The young girls and women who enthusiastically practice these self-defense techniques include 16-year-old Jagriti Chauhan. Just out of school, she's gearing up to counter sexual harassment of the kind her elder sister faced in college and public transport.
And you can not do anything because they're so huge and hulky and bulky. But now I'm thinking that if something happens with me, I will not be in her place, that I cannot do anything or just go in the washroom and cry. But I'm going to tell them that I am as equally strong as they are.
Harassment such as groping, lewd comments or being stalked has long been commonplace on campuses, on the streets and public transport in Delhi. But concerns about women's safety have been heightened following the reports of brutal sexual assaults in recent years. That is why the self-defense camps organized by Delhi police have become hugely popular, attracting thousands. About 350 turned up at this one. Inspector Renu Jadhav, who is in charge of this camp, says they teach girls how a quick response and presence of mind can help tackle men who tease or assault.
We've taught them to defend themselves, how you'll use your hands, how you'll use your scarf, and if you have a water bottle or pen, how you use these to fend off the attacker.
Undeterred by the scorching summer temperatures, many parents ferry their daughters to the two-week camp. Rama Cree, who has brought a 10-year-old daughter, wants to break the notion prevalent in many homes that girls and women should not step out alone.
Due to this training, I've stopped worrying about her. Looking at the atmosphere around us, all girls should learn this. So should their mothers, to ensure their daughters are safe.
Inspector Jadhav says, besides teaching self-defense, such training also empowers the girls.
Basically, our motive is that girls should never feel that they're restricted in any way.
Being a girl, you can do each and everything what the male can do.
Whether their newfound confidence reduces sexual harassment remains to be seen. But some of Delhi's women have decided to take matters in their own hands. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. Many Muslim Rohingyas who fled Myanmar went to other countries before coming to the United States. Some of those who have resettled in the city of Philadelphia came from Malaysia, where they were denied legal status and were not allowed to attend public schools. To help those refugees adapt to their new home, the Muslim community of South Philadelphia, together with Christian volunteers, hold extracurricular classes for Rohingya children. Alam Burhanan has more.
The northeastern state of Pennsylvania has taken in nearly 5% of the 2,100 refugees from Burma accepted into the United States between October 2017 and April of this year. In South Philadelphia, a small concentration of Burmese Rohingya refugees live together with a predominantly Muslim Indonesian community in this culturally diverse neighborhood. To help ease resettlement of Rohingya refugees, some residents open their homes to accommodate a weekly Islamic school. The school's principal says her priority is the education of refugee children.
It bonds the Islamic community in South Philly and gives the chance for our children to know one another.
They study Islam once a week, and once a month, Christian volunteers help teach subjects that are also taught in schools. Many of the children are Rohingyas. Daniel Demonsky from Liberty Church East says this activity helps the Rohingya children feel more at home in their new country.
We really don't want them to experience, any kind of hardship for being Muslim or for being Rohingya here in America. We want them to feel loved here, and so we hope to be able to just listen to them and learn more about them, and they can learn more about us, and we can become friends.
There are more than 100 Rohingya residents in Philadelphia. Most of them came from Malaysia and are married to Indonesians. Other than job opportunities in the U.S., Ismail is grateful that his children can go to school.
My daughter would cry because she was not allowed to go to school. She wanted to go to this private school, but she couldn't. I have to put my children first. I won't allow my status as a refugee to become my children's status. I have to think about them.
The weekly Islamic schools and the support of Christian volunteers have helped Muslim refugees adapt to their new life in a new country. For Alam Burhanan in Philadelphia, Aryono Arifin, VOA News.
From Philadelphia to Poland, where a man turned medical equipment into a musical instrument. Wooden tongue depressors used by doctors to examine mouths and throats are popular for making artwork. Arash Arabasadi has found an amateur musician who spent 6 months turning 1,300 pieces of wood into a working electric guitar.
This craft project is probably unlike any you've ever seen. Maciej Walaszek is an amateur Polish musician who turned more than 1,000 wooden tongue depressors into an electric guitar.
The whole guitar is made of 1,300 sticks. It is glued together in layers, and the body is hollow inside. The body has 22 layers, and the fretboard 36. Only that it is glued in a crosswise direction. It makes it more durable. The only wooden thing that is not made of spatulas is the fingerboard, which is made of plywood to make the whole thing look cool.
Walaszek spent 6 months cutting and gluing sticks he bought from a local pharmacy. He built a working electric guitar using the basic hardware at his disposal.
I did not use any heavy tools to create the guitar, as I simply did not have access to them. All the spatulas were cut with a normal paper knife. The whole shape was made with the use of a drill, hand planer, sandpaper, and nothing more. That is why it took me such a long time.
The true test of Walaszek's countless hours building the guitar comes when a guitarist picks it up and plays.
I am shocked. It is unbelievable. I am impressed that you can make something like that out of tongue depressors. It is in tune, it plays, its fretboard is straight, it just feels right in your hands.
Now that Walaszek finished building this unique musical instrument, the amateur guitarist will need to learn how to play it. That process may take some time, but considering he spent half a year custom building the guitar, the hardest part may already be over. Aras Farabasadi, VOA News.
Thank you for spending some time with us here on VOA Asia Weekend from the Voice of America. Make sure you tune in next week for another edition of our program, and make sure you keep up on what's going on in the world at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.